Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm feeling like a damsel in distress.
No way. How come? How come you're feeling like a damsel in distress, Rob?
Well, as you know, we're in the UK lockdown right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, luckily I'm turning 40 this year and I've realized that there is no Prince Charming to come save me and I have to like work out my own problems. And now I am stuck in a house alone and all I have is Talk Art. So I'm feeling a bit like Talk Art is saving me. But
could you feel like you want to grow your hair really long like Rapunzel and hang it out the window?
I think I do that all the time, babe.
you do that anyway.
Do you know what I mean? I think I do that just to like get guys' attention. I'm just like, I'm here. Hi, look at my plaits. The thing is, babes, about a week and a half ago, I think the date was the 18th of March, I logged onto Instagram and this video came up and it was our guest who we're going to be speaking to today singing a song. And that song has been something that's kept me going in the last week and a half. And it's also a song that you and I spoke about when we first started doing this podcast and we thought about who we could speak to.
Exactly.
And the reason I'm talking about Damsel in Distress, we will find out later, but that stream of music, which has been coming every day from our wonderful guest, is a bit like the Prince Charming that we all need right now. So Exactly. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art all the way from Hollywood, Los Angeles,
Rufus Wainwright.
Hello. Your knight in shining armor.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Knight in sequin armor.
Your knight in antiseptic armor.
How you doing?
I'm fine. I mean, my whole thing right now is to be really grateful in terms of having... I am very fortunate to not be alone. I have my most wonderful husband here with me. And also we have our fantastic daughter, Viva, who we spend time with as well. And we get to, you know, I don't know, she's loving this because she has, you know, full rule over her parents for the entire day, you know. So you just got to stay up for sort of, and look at it a bit through her eyes, because she's not in school and stuff, and she's liking that at the moment. So, as my 9-year-old self is very happy at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about, me and Rob were talking about a song that brought us together, but it's been a song that's been incredibly important to me. I first heard it when I was doing the History Boys years ago, and I remember just being completely blown away by it. And the song we're talking about is The Art Teacher. Yeah. Which I think for people who know Rufus Wainwright music will say that that's one of the diamond gems, the jewels of your repertoire. I mean, it's one of the most incredible, powerful, special songs that just stays with you. It's energy. And it's amazing for us to talk for Talk Art for you about that song and just would like to kind of pick your bones about how that came to be.
Yeah, well, let's see. I wrote that. That was on my album Want To. And I had, you know, I kind of made Want One and Want To at the same time. I mean, that's why they're kind of, it's in two parts, that whole period, because it was just a lot of material and a lot was going on in my life. Namely that, you know, before I went into the studio for a couple of years. I had been leading an incredibly decadent life in all the major cities of the world, and but then once I went in to record the albums, I was much better behaved after having gone to rehab and kind of, you know, confronted some of my demons. Anyway, mm-hmm. So it was a very dramatic period. But I think, you know, art teacher, I wrote it as a kind of exercise, really, in terms of possibly seducing a straight guy
right.
who happened to be an art teacher, a high school art teacher, and who was very, very flirtatious with me, and I think was also aware of the kind of, you know, infuriating power that he wielded, because I, you know, because we both knew that it wasn't really going to end up anywhere, but he, I don't know, nonetheless, he enjoyed it, the torturous nature, yeah, the chase, and
but he was a gay guy, right?
Oh my God.
He was gay.
He was gay and I was straight. And,
right. and, what country in the world was this as well?
So this was in New York. And,
okay, all right.
You know, he was sort of, I can't remember where I met him, but he was incredibly handsome and this sort of creature from Brooklyn, one of those Brooklyn creatures. And, and he was teaching art at an all girls school, and he would tell me these, you know, very salacious, I wouldn't say salacious, actually more suggestive stories where, you know, these girls would throw themselves at him in their, you know, uniforms, and he'd have to kind of bat them off. It was very kind of Sting, you know, it was like a Sting story or something when he was, because he was a teacher, right? A high school teacher. Anyways, so they were all obsessed with him. And he would kind of go on and on about this and very much to tantalize me with no, you know, end in sight. And anyway, so I then wrote the song from as if I was one of his pupils, and created this kind of, you know, story, I presumably based, you know, on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, where, you know, this very at this wealthy girls' school where the young girl is in love with her art teacher, but, you know, ends up having to marry an investment banker and, you know, lives miserably ever after.
A Turner painting, though. She has a Turner painting.
Yeah, and finally it gets a Turner painting. And so it was a fantasy that I was able to live out. But also, I have to say, an exercise, which I mentioned at the beginning, because it was, I don't often write songs that have nothing to do with my life. I mean, I'm more prone to be kind of confessional songwriter, and everything. Most of my work is just all about, you know, things that are happening. So this was, you know, more of an exercise in terms of creating a weird story that was, you know, that has its own life. So yeah.
Did he hear it? Has he heard the song?
Yeah,
he
I think I played it for him, and I don't know
what was his reaction
to him. Probably great, but I was also on crystal meth at the time, so everybody's reaction was great about everything.
Right. So wow. As well as the reference to Turner in that song, you also sing about Singer Sargent, like John Singer Sargent,
yes. The painter. Yeah, well, Singer Sargent is my favorite painter ever. If I could paint like anybody, it would be him. I mean, I love modern art too, and so forth. But years ago, and this actually took place in London around when I was in my early 20s, they had quite a famous retrospective of all his works at the, I think it was at Tate Britain, and I went to see it, and it was, I don't know, it just totally changed my life. That one exhibit of seeing all of his paintings in one.
Was you aware
space.
Of his work before this, though?
Yeah. No, I loved his work all through high school, and there was a book of his in the library at high school that I would kind of pile. You know, I would just gawk over, and his painting very much symbolized my interior kind of romantic longings, unfulfilled sexual desires, and this within this very I don't know, formal setting. And then, you know, because I went to boarding school in upstate New York, and it looked like a, well, it looked more like a Constable painting or something, but it was very, very, very idyllic, very beautiful place. And there was these sort of, you know, I was brought up in a kind of not a very wealthy family when I was in Montreal, because, you know, my mother's Canadian and we're just a little less flashy up there. And my life was kind of normal. Well, it wasn't normal at all, but it wasn't at all wealthy. But then when I went to boarding school, because I had, you know, started having sex with 35-year-olds at the age of 13. So I had to go to work a little bit.
Wow.
I was
in Montreal.
In Montreal. Anyways, so or maybe they were 25. They might as well have been 35. So I went away to boarding school to just sort of get my act together, and then suddenly I was thrust into this very upper class situation with most of the students who had, you know, Park Avenue apartments and stuff, and I would go hang out with them on the weekends, and I felt like I was living in I imagined I was living in a John Singer Sargent painting, so it sort of became like my backdrop or something.
So what, I mean, these kids would all have art collections.
Yeah, there you go. And they're, you know, alcoholic parents. But then I went to, finally, when I saw the exhibit and I saw all the paintings in person in London, they did not fail to disappoint.
Wow. And it sounds like he's really stayed with you, because I heard that recently you had a postcard of one of his paintings actually on your piano. So when you're playing, you even have his work like in front of you, which I found so interesting. Can you talk a bit about that particular painting?
Yeah, well, I don't know what it's called.
I think it's called Man Wearing Laurels.
Yes. A painting that I think is in LA. I think it's at the Hammer Museum. They have a couple of incredible John Singer Sargents. I think what it is that, you know, I tend to, you know, I studied art.
Oh, you did?
I went to an art school for about a year. I didn't do particularly well. I mean, I had talent. If I had applied myself, I think I could have done very well. But I was just more interested in going out and stuff. I've been in that atmosphere before.
Yeah.
I'm actually doing a lot of artwork now for my new album that'll be released. Yeah. So there'll be more stuff coming out. Anyways, I'm aware of the discipline that it takes, and in looking at all the paintings by everybody, and I mean in the sense like, yeah, from now until then, or for now, yeah, until then, from now until then, I like that. There's something about his work and the way he paints that just immediately hits, you know, the back of my head and also the kind of emotional core of my being, where it's just completely, I don't know. There's just, it's like a...
It's theatrical, just, I find it.
There's theatrical
and
there's
a fluency there. I find it very performative and very,
And it's very fluent. Like there's an effortless quality where he just obviously didn't have to think too much. He just sort of did it, and then like the emotion is just right at the head of the canvas, and so there's an immediacy to it that I find fascinating, and also it's very sexual too, which I like.
Yes.
This stuff, without being too sexual.
You were talking about drawing now for your upcoming record, and you've done the single Damsel in Distress, which Rob said was based on him, is you made a series of drawings for that, which have now been animated, right?
Yeah, that's from one of the drawings. I'm doing a drawing for each song for this album. So there will be...
So every release have like an animation to go with it?
No. There will be every... You know, single that we release will have different, you know, like videos or other ways of presenting it. But for each song, I'm doing an illustration, and then I'll release those illustrations. And my eventual goal, actually, is that I do a drawing for every song I ever wrote, which will take you know, the rest of my life. And then at some point, I will start to write something according to each drawing. And that'll be kind of wonderful. My biography. So, or, you know, which I don't know, it's just a way to, you know, stay indoors during the quarantine.
Was you drawing a lot before all of this? Are you someone that draws as well and sketches?
Yeah,
and...
yeah, no, I've always drawn. When I, in the 90s, back when you guys were, you know, children, or maybe not even born yet, I at a young age, I got very into the whole zine culture. Which was big back then, where people would write comic books and they were very homemade, very hands-on, and you would kind of print them yourself and distribute them at cafes and you know, rock shows and stuff, and punk rock shows especially. And so I got very, very into that scene, which was fantastic. I made zines. I made a zines. I had like an alter ego and this guy.
Tell Bella us about it. Who was the alter ego?
Bella von Herzgold.
Right. No, and what did they get up to?
Well, he lived with his mother, and they were kind of deposed Austrian royalty living in Argentina, and they had an estate with, you know, five different palaces on it, and each palace was a different, you know, there was a Chinese pagoda and a Renaissance ruin and a, you know, Rococo pavilion and stuff. So he would kind of just walk around from pavilion to pavilion looking, you know, for something to do. He was quite bored.
That is someone who likes John Singer Sargent. The theatricality, yes, to your zines. Yeah. Everyone else is doing like people fighting or like racing cars, and yours is like a guy walking around a baroque landscape.
No, I remember one of the things in the comic strip was like he had to mow the lawn, even though they had an army of gardeners, but it was his character building exercise. So he had to like mow, you know, 5 meters of the lawn, and that was like that episode, him mowing the lawn,
like an initiation.
Just to make him more manly, you know. That had nothing to do with my real life at all.
Right.
For the Damsel in Distress video, when I first watched it, I started thinking about Erte and kind of like black kind of ink drawings and things like that. And then I was also thinking of Joni Mitchell. And then I since found out that Joni actually inspired the writing of that song, which kind of really threw me.
Interesting. Yeah. No, the Joni is not the damsel in distress, but what happened is that I was never allowed to listen to Joni Mitchell growing up because my mother despised her for two reasons. One being that my mother was a fellow Canadian songwriter, very successful, but who was part of a much more conservative folk background. You know, they were very purist, and Joni for her was a kind of an abomination. On the other hand, I think my mother was jealous of her success and her money and stuff. So anyways, I didn't know a lot of Joni. And then finally, a few years ago, my husband, Jorn, became quite obsessed with her after doing a concert of her music for his festival. Anyways, and we befriended her, and I discovered her music late in the game. And the song itself is very much written in her style. It's written in a kind of Joni Mitchell style of music, which was actually pointed out to me by Martha Wainwright, my sister. She was the one who kind of brought that up. So there's that, and then... Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Erte thing, because actually I met Erte.
No way.
Because I was back in the early 90s or late. I must have met him. I think I met him. I think he died. Yeah, he died in the 90s, I think. I have to do some research because I'm pretty sure I met him because I was doing, there was a show.
No, you're right. He died. He died in April 1990. So
yeah,
it's possible
yeah, I
that
met
you,
him.
You
yes,
met him.
I met him. Yeah. I met him in the late '80s briefly because there was this Broadway show called Sophisticated Ladies, which was a big hit. And my friend's mother was the producer. Louise Westergaard. And so, and he had done all the costumes. So I met him, or I met him at a cocktail party very briefly. So, and I think that was, you know, an influence. I mean, the other big influence was, which is before that for me, is Aubrey Beardsley. Mm-hmm. And then I was also, as a kid, I was very influenced by Misha, the poster, the Czech poster guy.
Who's that? And, I don't know that work. What's that?
Misha, M-U-C-H-A. I can't remember his first name, but he was a... when you see his posters, you've seen them. They're very, very famous. Kind of Art Nouveau style.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like,
Le Chat. Is it Le Chat on it? Is it like Moulin Rouge style ones? Is that him?
Well, yeah, but it's a little more Eastern European. It's Czech.
Okay.
So he's more... once you see them, they're
recognizable.
They're kind of late 1800s as well, aren't they?
Yeah. They're more. Yeah, Art Nouveau. They're just totally Art Nouveau. He was like.
So when would you have first seen these? When you was in like Upper East Side housing.
We had a book at home in Montreal of his work, and it just really struck me. And I what's interesting is that I think it also. All of it very much corresponded with my love of opera, you know, which started early with me at around 13. That's when I started really loving opera and getting quite obsessed with it. And there's some, I always thought of it, I thought of art as more of like an advertisement, you know, for a production or for some kind of, I think, you know, if I was to become a professional artist, I'd try to be a painter, but I think in more cases I'd become like a graphic designer, you know,
illustrator.
You know, and I love the Wyeth family.
What's that? Who's that?
The Andrew Wyeth is a very famous American painter, and then his father was Wyeth. There's three of them. His father was he was a very famous illustrator who did all of like Treasure Island. The most famous illustration of Treasure Island, and then his son,
for the novel?
Andrew Wyeth. Yeah, the novel. Yeah, he did all these very famous illustrations for it. But his son, Andrew Wyeth, became probably America's greatest painter. And he is an amazing, he is more the, you know, deep artist. He did the famous painting of the woman in the field who's deaf and she's like looking at the house. He's probably America's greatest sort of painter. He died in the 80s. Yeah, Andrew Wyeth. He's incredible.
I think if you see it, you probably will recognize it. It's pretty iconic. I mean,
Wyeth, yeah, it's very iconic. Wyeth, he did like all the Helga paintings and stuff, which are incredible, which was his wife.
I also just started thinking about that whole Art Nouveau era, like quickly going back something, because your artwork for your later albums, like Want One and Want Two, there's a kind of like bizarrely Art Nouveau design within the way that you present the sleeves, which is also maybe related to like 60s kind of culture too.
I drew those things, that little frame. That's a drawing of mine.
Right.
So that's kind of I was hands-on involved with that. I mean, I will say it's interesting. It's very interesting right now with what's going on with the pandemic, because it has. I mean, I had the idea before this to do these drawings, but you know, fortune has made it that it's like the perfect outlet at the moment. To really lose yourself in this kind of whimsical and romantic and very, you know, it's somewhat playful, but it's also, there's a darkness to it as well. Decadent, I should say. kind of style of drawing things. Like, I'm not out there to paint my inner feelings right now, because it would be pretty rough, but I'm definitely into escaping into a more kind of ornate universe.
Have you ever shown your drawings anywhere? Have you ever shown them like in exhibitions, or would you ever consider
that? I will when I've done this set. I'm trying to figure out the best way to present the drawings, because I will say, and I'm not, you know, look, I've been quite active in the art world, only not making art, but my husband knows a lot about the art world, and you know, the best man at our wedding was my husband Jorn's best friend at the time, Klaus Biesenbach.
Whoa.
Who's like a big art guy, and then you know, we're friends with Marina Abramović, and we know, you know, so you know, I've been to the Biennale several times. And so we go to things, and I'm learning a lot. Jorn knows more, but I've been, you know, I've made some headway in the art world, just the scene and stuff, and you know, with Jay Joplin and all that, and it's been fascinating and great, and I love it. I will say that, and I can say this confidently, is that, you know, when I show people my drawings, there is a real reaction to them, in the sense, they're like, oh, this is really good, you know, in terms of what they are. I don't think that they're, you know, meaningful, or, you know, they're going to shatter the scene or anything. But in terms of some of the crap I've seen.
Well, I mean, like, Rufus, I'm the gallerist. And when I saw your illustration for the video, I was like, I loved it. I think it's brilliant, actually. And it does feel very you as well.
Yeah, it's very me. It's a bit like my operas, in the sense where, you know, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel at all. My influences are out in the open. If anything, I'm just trying to match kind of spirit of it, but in my own way. And I don't know. When I show my drawings to people now, they're quite taken with them. Yeah, so I'd like to do with something with them at some point, for
Amazing.
Sure.
So talking about your operas, I heard you describe your kind of relationship to opera as having this kind of supernatural quality. And I really liked
this.
And I also, incidentally, heard you talk about Singer Sargent's paintings and the way that he would paint as almost being like sorcery of light and having this kind of like magical quality. Can you speak a bit about that in relation to opera and art? Because I find that so endearing and so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, opera was basically my religion, especially at an earlier age when I was, you know, coming to terms with my sexuality. I was 13. As I said before, I'd been having some pretty dark experiences in that world, and also that world in general was dark to begin with, being that it was, you know, 1988, AIDS was everywhere. So opera suddenly presented itself as this kind of, I don't know, this sort of Bible of sorts that I could follow, and you know, because it was talking about, it was singing, people were singing about, you know, death and suicide and the end of the world and murder and rape, certainly, you know, because that had happened to me. And so I was, I don't know, it just, I related to that music in that visceral way. And then, you know, and it's been, and it's always stayed that way for me, opera. I at a certain point, I realized that, I don't know, it's also, just as a human being, art and music and anything in general, you kind of have to deal with it as a person at a certain point. Like, art will kind of accompany you and will show things and will give you inspiration, but then it won't save you from any of this stuff. So I had to kind of, I think it became less of a religion at that point, when I was a little older. But it's always maintained. I think what it is, what's nice about it, and I think this is probably what works with my artwork as well, and I think with anything that's decent, whether it's, you know, super amazing or just, you know, charming, is that there's a sincerity to it. You know, there's a kind of I'm doing it because I need to do it and I want to do it, and it's, and that is really the spirit in which I'm doing it, with completely, when it's happening. You know, I mean, I don't think that, I mean, yes, I think there's artists who make statements and who can revolutionize the world with their ideas. But I think in the process, when they're creating it, it's just, they're just like someone who's enjoying what they're doing. and that's what it's become, you know, opera and art for me. It's just that I enjoy it. I mean, it's very simple now, but,
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a 4-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a 4-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
And you're currently on your second opera, because you wrote one called Prima Donna. And then is it true that have you completed the Hadrian yet?
Yeah, it completed. It premiered in October last year. And then, you know, it's looking to come. Well, we'll see what's happening, you know, with everything. But it should be coming to Europe soon. So,
And is there this sense that when you're writing these operas that you're connected to the past, like to past spirits?
Yes.
Or like, you know what I mean? Like, because I love that whole supernatural element.
With opera, what has occurred so far with the two operas, and this is very real for me, is that at a certain, I mean, I'm obviously looking to do something. I'm searching for inspiration and stuff. And at a certain point, when I find a story or a scenario that I like, and this has happened twice, you know, because I have two operas, I do actually get a message from these characters in the back of, once again, in the back of my head, or deep down in my soul. And there's this kind of almost siren or cry or wail that goes on where I can literally hear the person saying, you know, you bring me to life. You know, you have to get me out of the, dig up the ground and save me, you know, because I need to be born. And it's a strange, it's a kind of
energy
a,
thing, yeah.
It's a psychic thing, and it's like a kind of possession, and I think it's quite common. I mean, for anybody who's writing a play or that involves characters that have to come into existence, and they are their own separate entities.
They start speaking, you know, for themselves, don't they? Weirdly, it's like you just are kind of a conduit, and they come out of you.
Totally. And it's going to be, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, this actually then goes into more your, you know, day job, Russell, which is, you know, the theater and so forth. And, you know, recently, I don't know if you know John Cassavetes' work?
Yes.
I'm just a big Cassavetes fan. I don't know. There's something, I imagine it's a lot the same with acting where, you know, there's a character that suddenly, you know, you're portraying. Mm-hmm. And they start to take control of you, and it's, you know, it's a bit of a battle. You know,
they lead you, don't they? I guess, but I think I think more so with writing, when you are developing a character, is that they start speaking for themselves and they find their own rhythm, and suddenly you're just facilitating that life form. That's
amazing. You have to get out of the way of their
path. Exactly. Weirdly,
you know, you have to get out of the way of their path, and you have.
Do you find that with your drawing as well? Then do you find that you are kind of your hand is doing its thing, and you're just letting it happen?
Yeah, I mean, with the drawing, look, I mean, the drawing, and this is, I think, what's very different about drawing and painting and, you know, visual arts is that you really have to do it a lot. In the sense, like, and I think this is, you know, returning to John Singer Sargent. I mean, obviously he did his homework, you know, he knows how to paint, you know, and that I also just appreciate too, the non-mystical quality of his work where it's like, this guy practiced really hard, at what he did, you know, and just knew how to draw a hand. I mean, it's like when, you know, knew how to draw a shadow or, you know, and, paint a shadow and properly. So you do that. And then the possession commences. And there's this, and it's interesting because when, you know, for instance, in talking about what I'm doing right now, I mean, I did have dreams at one point of being a great painter. And I think that if I had, you know, taken the time and not, you know, focused mostly on music, I could have been a very good painter. But it would have taken, you know, a long time to get there. And I'd have to be dedicated to it. And what's interesting about this drawing thing right now is that I always did it on the side. And, you know, as I said, when I was doing it in the zine world, and then later I did work for my record covers and then I did a couple of things here and there, and I kind of just kept it going on this basic level. And now I'm realizing, I'm like, this is what I do. This is my art. Like I don't think I'm going to become a painter. That's fine. But I have this, and maybe it'll go somewhere else eventually, but it's only after time that you've done it a lot. And then it kind of, and as you said, it starts to dictate its own path. Life. But it's through, you know, just putting in the effort and time and practice and stuff.
So for the music video for Trouble in Paradise, which was the first single for your new album, which is called Unfollow the Rules. But for that video, yeah. I started thinking about like Mapplethorpe and Warhol and kind of like loads yeah. of different like video art references. Were they things yeah. you yeah. were considering in that video? Because I love that video.
Oh, the Trouble in Paradise.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that yeah, we based it a lot on the, you know, the Warhol screen tests.
Yes.
To start with, because, well, for several reasons. One being we love it, but also it's also very inexpensive. We did not have a big budget, so we had to
Good
be,
one.
You know, it needed to have a kind of homemade quality to it regardless. So we did that, and yeah, I mean, I'm a huge Warhol fan. I adore Warhol. And that whole world as well. So,
did you ever meet him?
I never met. No, he died. I think he died in the 80s. I would have been a little young. I mean, I was alive, but I think what was he like 83 or something?
I think so.
In 1983. I mean, I knew his work. I knew a lot of people who knew him very, very well. I mean, who was, you know, one of my kind of big sort of aunties, shall we say, was this woman Penny Arcade, who was one of his.
Oh my God, I love her.
Yeah, one of it. Yeah, she used to like my dad. In realizing that I was gay and not knowing what the hell to do about it, kind of gave me to Penny Arcade to take care of.
And
it was her, and there was lots of afternoons. There was a couple of afternoons, which is kind of amazing, and could be like a play or some kind of shot, and I wish there was photographs, but there was a couple of afternoons of me, Penny Arcade, Quentin Crisp, and Jack Smith all hanging out in her loft when I was 14, you know, and they were kind of, you know, they were gentlemen, but it was, I mean, and I don't know if you know Jack Smith, but I've become very obsessed with Jack Smith.
He's totally.
A great artistic hero of mine.
What's his work
and
like?
Quentin was, Jack Smith was arguably, I would say, the most kind of rebellious New York kind of art protector in a lot of ways. I mean, he did these, you know, he was on a lot of drugs, obviously, and he did these performances that would last for days. But what he did, which was amazing, and which he believed very strongly in, which was not, I think, a drug delusion thing, was that museums were the worst things for art. And he would actually go out and picket museums. Like,
really?
Save the art. Like, he wanted to, you know, he believed that art belonged to everybody and that it shouldn't cost any money. You know, he was kind of a radical art guy, and he made a lot of films. And a lot of his work hasn't survived because it was all kind of disposable, and it was really the way he lived his life. But there's some incredible films.
He was also the major pioneer of performance art. I mean, without him, I don't think performance art would have become what it became.
Yeah. And he just believed in that everybody should do art and it should belong to everybody and it should never be, you know, even, I don't know. It's just he wanted no boundaries and stuff.
Well, he would have liked the UK because we've got a load of free museums. So he wouldn't have picketed here because everyone could go straight in here.
Yeah, no, but he wanted them out of, like, the rooms. I mean, he didn't want them framed. I mean, it was, like, it was very, I don't know. He wanted, I don't know. He was also crazy, but it was,
right.
But if you look at his films and his work, it's very liberating.
Can you remember the first art gallery you ever went to?
Yeah, well, the big art show that mostly affected me at a young age was, I mean, look, we would go down to New York a lot to see my dad, and we'd always go to MoMA or we'd go to the Met and stuff, and that did a lot. But one of the shows, for some reason, that really hit me at a very young age, I was about maybe 6 or 7, is that we were in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
It was very cold. It was the winter time, and there was this famous show that was traveling the world, and it was all of these paintings that had never been seen before from the Hermitage in Russia.
Wow, yeah.
And there was all these Matisses and Renoirs. And it was all, you know, Gauguin. It was all Impressionists. And it was traveling the world, and it was going to Quebec City, which was about 2 hours from, it was about 2.5 hours from Montreal. Anyways, and it was in the middle of winter in February, and it was freezing, bitter, bitter cold. And the entire family got into a station wagon, and we drove to Quebec City to see this show.
Wow.
And it was, there was something amazing about that experience where, I don't know, just, I mean, the paintings, of course, were incredible. But it was the idea that they had never been seen before in the Western world. And I don't know, just something behind the Iron Curtain. And somehow, maybe it was also just the weather outside. You know, we felt like we were in Russia or something. You know, it was just, I don't know. It was, for some reason, and I think, and then that the whole family felt like it was, you know, this was something that we had to go see that wasn't very often in Canada. I mean, my cousins never went to the United States. I did because my dad lived there, but this was, you know, culturally it was a big deal. So I think that was also that's, and then if anything, that's a good argument for museums, where, you know, a society can kind of gather around and celebrate some sort of culturally important,
yeah, totally,
facts that's yeah, occurring, and you know, and that affected me a lot.
I also loved the story of that trip, because I heard that you didn't, you take posters from the museum and then live with the,
yes,
posters.
Yeah, you know, I had the posters in my room, and yeah, it was just for everything kind of struck at the right time with that. Yeah, so that was sort of the biggest one when I was a small child.
Wow. That's awesome. Do you collect now? Do you collect art?
Yeah, we have a few things. You know, Jorn, my husband, he's from Germany, and he lived in Berlin for 10 or 12 years. So he's a big fan of, there's a guy called Jonathan Mazur.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Jonathan Mazur. I love him.
Yeah. We have,
oh, I know. Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. He does like the pirate men with like the mustaches and the big kind of big pirate hats and everything. Yes.
Yeah. And we have, there's also this really great friend of mine. His name is Timothy Cummings. He's a Californian. He lives in New Mexico, and he does more sort of Rococo kind of stuff that I love. He did the painting of me as the Elizabethan. When I did the sonnets, we have a lot of his work. We also have, what else do we have? I mean, we have a lot of photography. We have, you know, some Nan Goldens. And then we also have...
Have you met Nan Goldin? Do you know her?
We've never met her. No, Jorn might have met her. I've never met her. We have these pictures of these girls dancing. We have an Andy Warhol Polaroid, you know.
Oh, great.
I have some old... It's of Grace Jones.
Love.
So we have one of that. We love that. We also have Clementine Hunter. We have some of her stuff. I don't know if you know who she is.
No.
She's a famous
never heard of her.
American. Clementine Hunter, she was a kind of outsider artist who was this woman who was actually born, I think her parents were slaves. And I think she died in the 50s, but she painted in the South. And she painted... She might have actually been born a slave. There's something like that. But she had these beautiful paintings. Clementine Hunter, she's an amazing artist, black woman.
Are they like landscapes or are they figurative?
Yeah,
or?
They're landscapes. And they're like pictures of her farm that she grew up on, and, you know, of just life in the South from her perspective. They're very beautiful. Clementine Hunter, very beautiful and quite sought after now. And then,
where did you get them from? Where did you see them first?
We found out about them through and here him. We have a lot of works of, or, you know, my husband Jorn used to work with Robert Wilson, the theater director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love Robert Wilson.
We have a lot of Robert Wilson stuff, but he is obsessed with Clementine Hunter. So that's how Jorn learned about her. And then Jorn has a bunch of other things of with people's names I can't pronounce and
German
so
names.
Forth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So
Cool. Well, we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions, but also a bonus we're doing because we're in the lockdown time. But the first question we ask every guest is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world to yourself, you can steal it and keep it, what would that be and why?
Oh, God. If I, you know, if I had to, well, I would have to say Madame X, you know. It's probably John Singer Sargent's most famous painting, and it's at the Met. Yeah, I wouldn't mind having Madame X in the dining room for a while.
Oh, I know that painting. That was a really controversial one because didn't he get in trouble for it at the time?
She's standing up. Yeah, so yeah, it was his most kind of controversial painting, and it's
this
woman standing up and kind of looking away. And she has very beautiful skin. But Madame X,
Why was it controversial?
Because I think at the time, wasn't it too sexualized or something? And then he had to like edit it and change it later.
Sexy. Yeah, yeah. And she has the most amazing nose in art.
Yes.
If you check out her nose, she has a great
nose. Yeah, because it's
nose.
Like a side profile, isn't it, that you
yeah,
see?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would say, in terms of other paintings that if I was had a second choice from that era though, and these are paintings that have always fascinated me, but are all the Whistler paintings of London, the fog, with the green, these kind of crazy green portraits of London, where they're basically contemporary paintings. But with a little light here. And if you check out the foggy Whistler paintings of London.
The foggy day in London towns. You've got like Judy Garland.
There you go. There you go. There you go. So I wouldn't mind one of those Whistlers, but there you go.
The other question we ask every guest is a very simple one, but it's quite telling sometimes. What is your favorite color?
My favorite color is green, actually.
I knew you were going to say that.
Why is it green? I mean, it's just, I think mainly because I live in LA. And when it's green, it means we're not going to burn up in flames.
Yes.
So I think living in a fire-conscious area, you kind of really love green inordinately.
We've got the other question we're asking everyone now during this quarantine series is that what is your hidden lockdown talent? I think we know because you're doing your drawings, but is there anything you've discovered that you didn't know you could do until you've slowed down now?
Oh, my Lord. Well, I've become quite the chocolate connoisseur.
Me too. Oh, my God.
I really know the varieties available on the market. And so, yeah.
What's your go-to? What's your go-to chocolate?
Chocolatier.
Chocolatier.
Belgian chocolate.
Yeah.
I've been drinking chocolate milk, which is quite apt because we're talking to you.
Oh boy!
But instead of it being dairy, it's chocolate oat milk by Oatly, which I love.
Oh, and have you been smoking cigarettes with it?
I know that.
You can
vape and do that.
Exactly, vape and chocolate oat milk. That's your new single.
Yeah.
vape and chocolate oat milk. That's got the same ring as cigarettes and chocolate milk.
You know what else, Rufus? I've just been thinking, like, when you were talking about going to see that North American tour of the Matisse and Gauguin show in Quebec City and how cold it was there and how you almost felt like you were in Russia. When I first discovered your music, I was actually spending a lot of time in Montreal and I was there for a good period of time. And I was originally a singer-songwriter, so I was kind of always looking at music. And I knew Imogen Heap and I worked a bit with her. And she toured with you.
I love her.
And I remember being very distinctly that whole period of time when your first record came out and you did that Gap TV advert. And Montreal was freezing cold and you had that like ice storm. Yes. What an insane time it was.
You were there for
it was
that.
Like a lock-in
time. That was actually the first natural disaster that I ever kind of experienced. So I wasn't in Montreal. I was in New York. There was this amazing ice storm in Montreal where the whole city was shut down for over 2 weeks.
It was crazy.
Because all the power lines had gone down and people died and stuff. I mean, it was sub-zero
And funnily enough, it's quite similar to how we're all being locked down now. And it kind of struck me that it's the kind of thing that hardly ever happens in life. And that when these strange things do happen, you know, you kind of turn to music or you turn to art or, how we all survive through that.
Very true.
So have you been enjoying doing the whole Quarantunes videos?
Yeah, no, I have enjoyed that immensely. And I'm really getting a lot of feedback in terms of it being helpful to a lot of people. And
oh my God, it's amazing. Your robe recitals, Song a Day. Yeah.
That really, I feel great. I mean, I think we all have to do more in terms of, you know, whatever it's going to be, all hands on deck or all no hands on deck. no hands on deck.
Yeah, don't touch. Yes, gloves on deck. Yeah.
I heard that when you were 14 or 15, you had a really close friend called Frederick and that you told him a really amazing phrase, which I would love you to tell us now.
Oh, boy.
Can you remember?
I did. Oh, my God,
well, it's basically all about how art is all that matters and that you tried to convince him about this. I just loved that. I thought it was really touching that, you know, you as an adolescent, you felt so passionately that art was going to save the world.
I just told him that our art was his whole thing. We got into an argument about, you know, what was the most important thing in society and the world, and he was saying, oh, you know, politics and money and, I don't know, war. And I said that basically art was the most important thing because that's all that we have. That's all that's left, you know, of those great, you know, if you go look at Napoleon's age or, you know, the Egyptians, like all that's left is the art in the end. So it's all that it's the only thing that really matters is the art.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's all that's left in the end.
And I love that idea of being able to somehow you get to get close to that era through the artifacts and through the art. Like that's almost like your kind of portal to that time.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, that is the closest you will get, especially with music in the sense, you know, to hear a piece of music from that, you know, a Beethoven symphony or something. I mean, that is how that is it. I mean, that is what happened.
Yeah,
so
totally.
That's the closest you can get.
Wow.
I'm actually writing that down. All that's left in the end is art.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. True though. All that's left in the end is art.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on, Rufus.
Thank you, Rufus.
Okay.
We love you.
Care. Are you guys in New York or London or what?
London.
Or where? You're all in London.
Rob's in Margate, if you've heard of Margate, and I'm in London.
Yeah. No, I have. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So we're there.
Well, I was going to be over there in July. Who knows? But when I do set sail, I'll let you all know.
And is your album still coming out in April?
It's been moved. Yeah. It's going to come out in July now.
Okay, it's coming out in July. Okay.
But everybody should follow your Instagram at Rufus Wainwright to hear your robe recitals where you do a song a day in your dressing gown at the piano, which is just wonderful.
And Rufus's new album, Unfollow the Rules, will be out in July. And we'll be posting photographs on Instagram at Talk Art of all the artworks we've discussed today. And we'll be back very soon. Thank you, Rufus.
Thank you, Rufus. We love you.
Thank you.
Take care.
I love you too. Bye. Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.